Last time I told you the pressure of materialism towards the seeking of pleasure, and then I mentioned that the Taittiriya Upanishad speaks of levels of ananda, of bliss. Normally, the materialist argues that if he is not allowed to go to the extreme end of his seeking of pleasure, something will be missed by him. And in that train of argument, he appeals that he should be left free to go right to the end of that experience of seeking of pleasure, so that he does not feel regret afterwards that he has missed something. Now, here is a description of the kind of bliss that is still available, which materialist in any case is going to miss, however much he may try to gain through his process of seeking pleasure. Now, what are the levels of bliss which are available, which have been experienced by the rishis? Now, these are described here, and which are available to one who has gone into his soul and entered into soul experience. And this is what is to be presented to whoever wants to know what are the kinds of happinesses which are available. And then, having seen it, this is only what is called Shruti. You just listen to this experience. It is not meant for converting anybody. It is only to present to him that here is an experience of the rishi, of the extent of the bliss that is available if one pursues the experience of the soul. As against the materialist who says that if he does not pursue his method of seeking pleasure, maybe that he will miss something out. Therefore, he says, allow me the freedom to pursue my own methods and go right up to the end of it, so that I do not have regret afterwards that I missed out something. It was available to me and I couldn't get it. So here is a description of the bliss that will never be available to him. Even at his best, even if he tries it at most, this is the kind of bliss which is described, which surely is absent. He will never be able to get it. So let us read what the Taittiriya Upanishad says about it. I omit the first two lines. You start with behold, third line in the middle. Behold this exposition of the bliss to which you shall hearken. Let there be a young man, excellent and lovely in his youth, a great student. Let him have fair manners and a most firm heart and great strength of body, and let all this wide earth be full of wealth for his enjoying. That is the measure of bliss of one human being. Now a hundred and hundredfold of the human measure of bliss is the one bliss of men that have become angels in heaven. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise whose soul the blight of desire touches not. A hundred and a hundredfold of this measure of angelic bliss is one bliss of gods that are angels in heaven. And this is the bliss of the Vedwise whose soul the blight of desire touches not. 100 and 100-fold of this measure of divine angelic bliss is one bliss of the Father's, whose world of heaven is the world forever. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise, whose soul the blight of desire touches not. 100 and 100-fold of this measure of bliss of the Father's, whose worlds are forever, is one bliss of the gods who are born as gods in heaven. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise, whose soul the blight of desire touches not. 100 and 100-fold of this measure of bliss of the firstborn in heaven is one bliss of the gods of work who are gods, for by their strength of the deeds they depart and are gods in heaven. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise, whose soul the blight of desire touches not. 100 and 100-fold of this measure of bliss of the gods of work is one bliss of the great gods who are gods forever. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise, whose soul the blight of desire touches not. And 100 and 100-fold of this measure of divine bliss is one bliss of Indra, the king in heaven. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise soul, whose soul the blight of desire touches not. 100 and 100-fold of this measure of Indra's bliss is one bliss of Brihaspati, who taught the gods in heaven. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise, whose soul the blight of desire touches not. 100 and 100-fold of this measure of Brihaspati's bliss is one bliss of Prajapati, the Almighty Father. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise, whose soul the blight of desire touches not. 100 and 100-fold of this measure of Prajapati's bliss is one bliss of the Eternal Spirit. And this is the bliss of the Veda-wise, whose soul the blight of desire touches not. The Spirit who is here in a man, and the Spirit who is there in the Son, it is one Spirit, and there is no other. He who knows this, when he has gone away from this world, passes to this self which is of food, he passes to this self which is of prana, he passes to this self which is of mind, he passes to this self which is of knowledge, he passes to this self which is of bliss. Wherefore, of this is the scripture. The bliss of the Eternal, from which worlds turn back without attaining, and mind also returns baffled. Who knows the bliss of the Eternal? He fears not for aught in this world or elsewhere. Verily, to him comes not remorse, and her tormenting saying, why have I left undone the good, and why have I done that which was evil? For he who knows the Eternal knows these, and delivers from them this his spirit. Yea, he knows both evil and good for what they are, and delivers his spirit. Who knows the Eternal, and this is the Upanishad, the secret of the Veda. Together may he protect us. Together may he possess us. Together may we make unto us strength and virility. May our reading be full of light and power. May we never hate. Om, peace, peace, peace. So this is the charter of the discovery of the soul. And this is the bliss. You need not be God yourself to go into heaven to have that bliss. Even here, If by learning the Veda, by knowing the true knowledge, if the soul attains to a stage where desire does not touch him, then all this bliss is his. Now let us come back to, this is only because I promised last time that there was a statement in the Taittiriya Upanishad where what is available to man is described in the field of happiness. This is the conquest of happiness. Now I said that we shall now enter into dialogue with the materialist. And I had said, first of all, there are two basic propositions of the materialist, which I described last time. First of all, I had said that materialist has an easier field where he can simply kick the football and prove that matter exists. So, he has a very easy field to prove. You don't need to argue in long train of reasonings. A mere kick of the football is sufficient to prove matter exists. You can't deny the fact that matter exists. You open your eyes and you see matter. Matter exists. The second argument of his was that what you call consciousness is simply a result of the functioning of physical organs. Therefore, what is primary is not consciousness but the movement of organs, which are physical. So, his argument is that consciousness is a product of the physical movement of organs. So, consciousness is not original, it's a product. As in the example which I have given, the sting is a product of piston movement, not the other way around. And the materialist friend is a rustic, as I had said last time, who stands on the platform, looks at the engine, and is convinced that piston is the cause of the steam. And he doesn't have the patience to wait for your argument by which he can be taken into the engine and he can be shown that piston itself is a result of the force of steam. Therefore, he commits a mistake of judging only from outside and being too much in a hurry to do something else, he doesn't have time even to look into further argumentation. So, first of all, we have to tell the materialist in our dialogue, please wait. Do not merely stand outside the engine. You go inside the engine. I will try to show you something else. Normally, the materialist is not ready to entertain even this kind of a statement. He's too much in a hurry. But sometimes rationalists believe and they want to convince you that they are rationalists. Now that is the starting point where you can have a dialogue. The moment he says, look, I am a materialist but I am a rationalist. And the moment he says rationalist, you have a kind of a hook. Then you can ask a question. What do you mean by rationalism? Because now he's put into the dock. What does he mean by rationalism? His answer is, a rationalist is one who accepts any belief when it is proved. It's a very simple answer, that a rationalist is one who holds or accepts a belief when it is proved. So the word proving is a very attractive word. And the whole world today, everybody, whenever there is a question of argumentation, anything which is connected with rationalism, it is always connected with this idea of the proof. So materialist says, my position is based upon rationalism because it is based upon a proof. Fine. Then I ask him, proceed with your proof. So as I said, his field is very easy. He can simply kick the football and say, here is matter. You can see it. Therefore, I have proved matter exists. Now, I turn into a dialogue with him. He said, all that you have to prove or you have proved, your case is finished? He said, yes. My case is proved. You just open your eyes, see me kicking the football. This is matter. This is all that you want to say, that matter exists? Nothing more than that? And gradually, when I put the question several times, he adds one word to his statement, which is very interesting. He has proved matter exists. Then he says, matter alone exists. Now, this is a very important qualification. A materialist is not one who merely believes that matter exists. If that was his position, there is no denial of this fact. You need not disagree with him, no argumentation with him. The string of materialism is the statement that matter alone exists. And even what we call consciousness is nothing but a consequence of matter. It's a result of the movement of physical organs. So if somebody says, what is materialism? A true statement of materialism is matter alone exists. Fine. We shall come back to this statement a little later. I again have another statement of a dialogue. What is the proof that matter exists and matter alone exists? Said, your physical perception, open your eyes. When your physical senses open, then they give you evidence of what exists. Fine. I do see the football. I can't deny the fact. I can't deny that matter exists. But when I go to a physicist who is a master of the knowledge of matter, he tells me what this football is, what this matter is, and surprisingly he tells me that this is not what matter is, what you see. This is what the physicist tells me. Matter is not what you see. This is something which is composed of a number of atoms which you are not able to see at all. Physically, you are not able to see these atoms which are there. But the physicist tells me there are atoms. And I ask the question, do you see the atoms? Your first proof of matter was that you can see by your physical senses. Can you see by physical senses the atoms? This is more difficult for the materialist to prove that you can see atoms physically. Now he goes further. That even these atoms are not what they appear to be. First of all, matter is not what it appears to be. Even atoms, which are still immortal, are not really what they are. Atoms can be still further analyzed. And in each atom you find a big solar system. a nucleus around which there are so many electrons which are moving with a tremendous speed. And all this is nothing but energy, which physically cannot be seen at all. That is certain. The energy which is here in all this matter is something which you cannot see physically at all. Therefore, now the materialist has to change his position. His first proposition was that what you see physically is the proof of what exists. When I bring him up to this point, now he has to change his position. He has to say that although energy cannot be seen, energy is a presupposition on the basis of which all that you physically see can be explained. Although energy cannot be seen, it is that energy which you have to assume to be existing in order to explain what you can see physically. Fine. Therefore, now, this is his one line of proposition, one of the remotest line of his argument. But how do you know that energy is the ultimate assumption, that there is nothing beyond energy? Is there any way by which you can show that is the only ultimate assumption on the basis of which all that is here can be explained? So his answer is, so far this is all that I have done. My homework is up to here. Whether there is something beyond it or not, at least I have not been required to inquire further, because this is the farthest I have gone. But now he is really tired. Already you have gone far enough, and if you still persist in your question, how do you say that energy is the last point of the assumption, the basis of which you can explain this matter? So he says, if I go farther, I will come back to you. Till that time, let me be now left with what I have. This is where the materialist ultimately stops in his argument. When you have a dialogue with him, he stops at this point. This is one kind of a trajectory, our journey with the materialist. Then he comes back again with you, and you can start another trajectory with him for a dialogue. He had said that when you open your eyes, you see matter. Now, even on that ground, my argument is, do you see that matter alone exists? There is no doubt about the fact that matter exists, and I will not dispute with that fact. Matter exists. But you do not see anywhere that matter alone exists. To make a statement that matter alone exists, you should claim that you have seen everything in the world, all that can be seen, before you can make a statement that matter alone exists. It is not sufficient to say that whatever you see is matter. Quite true. So far, whatever you see is matter. How do you come to the conclusion that matter alone exists? Now, again, he's tired. Because then you might say that, well, he says, well, whatever I have seen is this. So until I have seen everything, don't come to me and discuss this question. So this is the second line of trajectory where the dialogue stops. Now there is a third line of trajectory with him. Come back again. You said in the beginning that physical organs give you the evidence of matter, which is fine. Therefore, you conclude that physical organs as a means of evidence and knowledge. Is this all that you want to say? So when you press him, he will make another statement. And that is, that physical organs are the only means of knowledge. Just as in the other case he had added the word alone, matter alone exists, now he makes a further statement that physical organs are the only means of knowledge. So again you have to ask him the question, how do you know that physical organs are the only means of knowledge? Have you examined all kinds of evidences, all kinds of means of knowledge? Then having done all that, have you come to the conclusion that these are the only means of knowledge? His answer is, so far, my knowledge is derived from physical senses. That is fine. If he makes only this statement, there is nothing wrong about it. Very honest statement. So far, I have done whatever knowledge I have got is from physical organs. So remember, in this dialogue, we have actually attacked two important propositions of materialism. Statement that matter alone exists and that physical organs are the only means of knowledge, for which materialist has no proof. He has proof to say that matter exists, but he has no proof to show that matter alone exists. He has a proof to say that physical organs are the means of knowledge, but he has no proof to show that material organs are the only means of knowledge. Sometimes, of course, he enters into an argument. This is the fourth trajectory. This argument runs as follows. Matter alone exists. That's the starting point. As materialism says, matter alone exists. He asserts matter alone exists. And I shall now prove to you, matter alone exists. What is the proof? That physical organs are the means of knowledge by which you see that matter exists. If you ask the question, are the physical organs the only means of knowledge? He says, they have got to be. Why? Because matter alone exists. This is his argument. The weakness of this argument will be evident because I have put the argument in such a clear way that the weakness of the argument is visible. Very often it is put in such a roundabout manner that you do not see the steps of the argument. But now let us repeat again so that we may see the step again. First statement is, matter alone exists. And he says, I will prove it. This is not yet proved. Matter alone exists is a thing to be proved. Now he goes about proving it. What is the proof? Physical organs, when they operate, they give you the evidence of matter. Then he says, physical organs are the only means of knowledge. And if you ask the question, how do you know they are the only means of knowledge? And his answer is, because matter alone exists. Therefore, there cannot be any other means of knowledge excepting physical organs. Now, you will see that actually doesn't prove. What is to be proved, he takes it as a part of argument. In logical terms, you might say that what he wants to prove as a conclusion, he takes it as a part of the premise. Now, when this is done in logical terms, it is called circular reasoning. Circular reasoning is one in which you start proving a statement and before arriving at the conclusion, you use that premise, that proposition as a premise, which requires no proof. No premise requires a proof. So that which is to be proved, he starts by saying, I will prove it. But while going through the process of reasoning, he suddenly introduces that proposition as a premise, which does not require any proof. And then, having said it, he repeats it in the conclusion, therefore matter alone exists. Matter alone exists, therefore matter alone exists. This is the circular reasoning. So you might say materialism commits the fallacy of arguing in a circle. That is why Schrodinger also calls it a rustic error. An error which only an uninstructed villager can commit. Because he doesn't know what is proof, and he repeats his statements without proving and thinks that he has proved. Now these are the four trajectories of materialism. This is one set of argumentation with materialism. Now there is another set of argumentation with him. Recognizing this is an advanced stage. Now he recognizes that he has not been able to prove that matter alone exists and that material organs are the only means of knowledge. He has not been able to prove. Knowing this, many materialists talk only here. And they simply say that I don't want to argue further because if I ever see something else than matter, I'll come back to you. If I ever have some other means of knowledge which are not used by physical organs, I'll come back to you. So he rests there. He is busy with the platform. He is not ready to go into the engine. But there are some others who clearly see that they have not been able to establish that matter alone exists and that physical organs are the only means of knowledge. They clearly see that their case cannot be established on these two grounds. So they take a new stand. What is the new stand? He does not now make a statement that matter alone exists. Because he sees that if the moment he makes a statement, it is difficult. So he does not make a statement that matter alone exists. Now you have dialogue with him. If he makes a statement that matter alone exists, he knows that you will trap him. So he does not argue with you at all. He even says, look, I don't wish to have a dialogue with you. If you wish to have a dialogue with me, you are allowed to do so, but I don't want any dialogue with you. Now, you, like many good teachers, are very anxious. Now, you happen to be one of those anxious teachers who want to convert people. So they want to convert the materialists. So they say, all right, we want to dialogue with you. You may not like to have dialogue with me, but I want to have dialogue so that I want to uplift you, to take you out of this materialistic groove, which is wrong. So it's all right. If you want to dialogue with me, you are allowed to talk to me. But remember, I do not want to talk to you. That is a starting point. This is how your position is weaker right at the beginning. There is no other way of making you weak. So this is one of the methods of making you weak right from the beginning, saying, I don't want to have dialogue with you. If you want to have dialogue with me, fine, come along. So now you start a dialogue with him. And you say, you know, there is soul, there is spirit, there is transcendental, there is invisible, there are miracles. unexpected things happen in the world. So he shows no sign of response, because he is not dialoguing with you. You want to bring about a point where he can start a dialogue. Now you make all your big statements. What are finished now, your statements? There is a soul, there is spirit, there is transcendence, there is miracle, there are unexpected things which happen, incredible things that happen. But he shows no sign at all of having been moved at all. Then, when you repeat your statements, he doesn't show any sign at all of any response at all. Then you got exasperated and say, "Do you understand what I tell you?" Say, "No, I don't understand." This is his greatest weapon. He said, "I don't understand at all. Souls, spirits, transcendental, incredible things. I don't understand any one of these things at all." What you say, at the most you might say, is to me Greek and Latin. But even Greek and Latin, when you learn Greek and Latin, it makes meaning. So he says, even if it is not Greek and Latin, it is purely abracadabra. In no language it can have any meaning. It is purely, what you are saying is simply noise. That I admit. You are making a noise, I can see that. The word soul, spirit, all these words are making noise, but makes no sense to me at all. Therefore he says, all that you are saying is nonsense. In the real sense of the term nonsense, not merely in a pejorative sense, not that you are thrown out. He simply really says what you are saying is nonsense. He stands aloof like Himalayas. Immovable, you can't change him now. There was some chance of a dialogue, but now dialogue is not possible. Now, you are wondering as to how to move this. You are a good teacher, you want to teach him, you want to give a message to him, but he simply says that when you give a message, he says that it makes no sense to me at all. He does not even understand that, he doesn't dispute with you. He doesn't say soul does not exist. He doesn't say spirit doesn't exist. He simply says, "I don't even understand, therefore I don't know even chance of disputing with you." You will argue with him if he understands and says he doesn't exist. Because then you can ask for a proof of non-existence. Then the task becomes difficult. But now it is such an easy thing. Now you are therefore in a great difficulty as to how to converse with him on your pet subject. If you really want to go ahead with, how to deal with it. Then you ask him, "Don't you feel that when I know something and you do not know something, don't you feel that there is some inadequacy?" Don't you see that? I think I understand you, so you don't understand. But he is immovable. He says, "I don't really understand. Make me understand, then I can at least argue with you or go up air with you. But make me understand." Then you ask him a question. "Tell me, what is your definition of understanding?" It's a good way of opening the dialogue. When he says what you are speaking is nonsense, in a certain sense, he has now given you the final disproof and thrown you out of the court. But if you are clever, you will ask him, "Fine, if it is nonsense, tell me what is sense." Therefore, there is a point of having a dialogue now. It's a linkage of a dialogue. "Tell me what is sense." Now you would like to answer. He can't say, "Well, even this I don't understand." Because he himself has used the word nonsense. The fact that he has used the word nonsense, he knows what is sense. In comparison with which what you are saying is nonsense. So asking, what is sense? So he thinks over the question and comes back with an answer. No words have sense. This is the first answer. No words have sense. You are using words, soul, spirit, all that. So his first answer is, no words have a sense. But words derive a sense. In themselves they have no sense. All words are nonsense. All are abracadabra. But words derive their sense from experience. Whatever is experience makes sense. Fine, this is a good progress in dialogue. He has come up with a statement that what can be experienced is sense. Then you ask the question, all that you can experience is necessarily sensible? Say yes, but all that is sensible is not necessarily true. All that can be experienced makes sense. But all that makes sense is not necessarily true. So he makes a further space for you to dialogue. He makes a distinction between all that can be sensed or experienced and all that is true or not true. Now, why does he say this? Because if he doesn't say, you will trap him. So beforehand he tells you in the very beginning, before you trap him, I see that a stick which is straight, when it is put into water, I see it bent. So the word bent stick makes a meaning. It's sensible. I see a bent stick. But it doesn't mean that bent stick is true of the stick. The truth of the stick is that it is straight. Now, before you can point out this experience and prove him to be somewhat weak, he himself starts by saying that I make a distinction between that which is sensible and that which is true. Fine. Then what is the definition of true? The definition of true, he says, is that which is verifiable. In the case of the bent stick, it is bent only so long as you don't verify it. When you take it out, verify whether it is really bent or not, you find it is not bent. So that which is verifiable is true. Fine, very good. You have made a good progress in dialogue. Then you go forward. What is the meaning of verifiable? What is verifiable? Now here again he comes to a difficult terrain. He has to take a great care to see that you don't trap him, because he knows that you are quite an adversary, quite powerful in your own way, but he doesn't want to be trapped. So when you ask the question, what is verifiable? So he says in the first place, that which is again and again physically seen is verifiable. That which is again and again, what is called objective. You see it, I see it, he sees it. Several people, when they all confer and they come to the conclusion that yes, we all have seen, that is called verifiable. Fine. But why do you say that we only that which is verifiable in physical perception is called verifiable? Now it is at this point that he is really cognizant. If he says that physical senses are the only means of knowledge, then you know your argument. How do you know that physical means are the only means of knowledge? So he won't make that argument. This is where the latest materialism stands, you might say. He has still not responded to your question. The dialogue in the world with the materialist stands here. The first dialogue is over, although many people are still making the dialogue of the first kind. But more advanced make the second kind of dialogue which I have presented to you. They have still not responded to your question. Now, if you tell them, that is the third category of dialogue people. The second great philosophers do not answer this question. They are still waiting to answer your question. They have not been able to find an answer. There is a third category of materialists who said that we should not limit ourselves only to those experiences which are physically verifiable, they admit. But he asks you the question, I grant that you may have some experiences which are not physical. But tell me, what is it that you are experiencing? Now you are thrown back again to the same device. You say, I experience soul. And then he says, I don't understand what you are saying. He repeats the argument of the second great philosopher and says, I don't understand what you are saying. Then you tell him that what I am saying is somewhat quite different. When you say it makes no sense to you, fine. It makes no sense to you because you are accustomed so far to only one kind of sense, namely physical verification. Now you have admitted that physical verification is not the only thing. So yes, that is true. Would you like therefore to enter into a field which is not physical? So he says, look, first of all, I don't do that patience because I am very busy with what I am doing now. But still, if you are very insistent, being a friend, I will have a dialogue with you. So go ahead, I will spend some time with you in a friendly chat. Then you argue and point out that, look, my dear friends, I know that you are basically seeking a proof in terms of physical verification. But I also know that because that proposition is not sustainable, you have at least agreed with me that you are prepared to admit that there is some other way of knowing things, other way of verification. But before I proceed further, tell me an answer to one question which I will put to you. I make very direct statements that soul, spirit, words which are not understood by you are all supraphysical. They are not physical. They are supraphysical. Do you agree with the proposition that the supraphysical cannot have physical proof? Just answer this question. Do you agree that supraphysical cannot have physical proof? Do you admit with me that if somebody says, show me the invisible, would it not be irrational? You have agreed that you are rational, all of you are rational. then would you not agree that when you say, show me the invisible, is it not irrational? You are demanding a physical proof of something which I declare is supraphysical. Now this is a thing which is, how can it be denied? If I say that there is something supraphysical, and if somebody says, show me, it is really a rustic argument. A villager who does not understand is arguing, show me the invisible. I am saying it is invisible. He says, show me. Do you agree that in asking a physical proof of a supraphysical, you are irrational? And he, on this question, he has got to admit your position. If it is really supraphysical, you can't have a physical proof. Therefore, my demand of a physical proof is itself beside the point. He said, all right, I grant it. But show me invisibly the invisible. Isn't it? Now, it's a fair argument. It's a good dialogue. Show me the invisible invisibly. Now, you can see the dialogue is coming to a very narrow path. Now, for you, it's a very big task. Because now for you, the moment of truth has come for you now. Up till now you are only arguing with him to bring him out of his errors. But now maybe that you will be found to be in erroneous position when he proves it to you. By granting simply, show me invisibly the invisible. So your first answer will be that there is an experience, there is an inner experience in which I see what is not normally seen by physical eyes. For example, I see visions. I close my eyes and I see various kinds of visions. I see colors. I see numbers, I see figures. This is the invisible seeing invisibly. It's a fact. Not only that, but I find in these experiences something quite remarkable. So his answer is, you know, when you close your eyes and when you see, they are only after images. You are seeing a physical object. Having seen that physical object, when you close your eyes, you see the same object continuing for some time. This is called an after image. So, of course, this experience I have myself. You're closing your eyes and seeing something, I have also the experience. This is all that you mean by invisibly seeing invisible. This is all that you see, isn't it? Oh, that is nothing. It's only an after image. It's purely a physical impression continuing for some time. This is what you call invisible. It is true that when you close your eyes, that object is not before you. But it is simply an impression of the physical object on the physical organs, which is persisting for some time. Where is your grand victory of something that you are speaking about, transcendental and all that? Now you answer saying that, no, my dear friend, tell me, what is an after image? Can after image be sustained for quite some time? Because the images that I see when I close my eyes are not really after images, because I know what is an after image. And I also know what my vision tells me. And one distinction between the two is that after image remains only for a very short time. And after that is gone, it can't be repeated. You can't have after image. One after image, and again repetition of after image, another same time, third time after image.
Whereas the visions that I see are not of that kind. I have seen a figure. When I close my eyes, that figure I don't see at all. I see something quite different which I have not seen just now. That I see. This is where he finds it difficult now. You have given a good answer. That there are experiences which are not of the type of after images. So he comes up with another argument. And he says, maybe that this is your personal idiosyncrasies of your brain. Your brain is such, it rattles with some of the images of yesterday or day before yesterday or something other. It's a very special kind of your subjective experience. Now, this is a big argument in regard to subjectivity. He says, as far as my knowledge is concerned, all my knowledge is objective. My verifiability principle implies that what I state is experienced not merely by myself, is experienced and shared by many other people. Then only I declare it to be knowledge. But now you are coming with a subjective experience. And subjective experience, a madman may see 100 lights. It doesn't mean 100 lights exist. If you are drunk, you might see several things which are not there at all. It's purely subjective. It has nothing to do with the world as it is. Or reality of any kind, whether visible or invisible. Even if I grant you invisibility, it is pure imagination, pure hallucination. Your theory of invisibly seeing invisible is a theory of hallucinations. And that is where he dismisses you, finally. Now, what is the answer to his question? This is where the third dialogue stops at this point. He would agree that there may be invisible, there may be invisible perception of the invisible, he may grant. But if your invisibility seen by invisible means is going to be only subjective, then it can be dubbed or stigmatized to be nothing but pure hallucinations, having very little value as far as knowledge is concerned. So this is the triumph of materialism against you. At this stage, you now come forward and say, my dear friend, let us not dismiss argument at this point. Continue with me. This is where the materialist normally puts off his hands. Not by any argument, he just puts off his hands. He does not have the patience with you now. And he feels, I have already been victorious against you. I have disputed you. All your experiences are hallucinations, subjective, unverifiable in any objective manner. Now what more do you want to ask me about? Besides, I've got a lot of other things to do. You are just taking away my time. I had, for the sake of argument, I had just allowed you to argue with me. I considered some points of yours also. But now what further? Normally, this is the third point at which the dialogue of the present time has stopped. The materialist is not prepared to go further in the dialogue. He has thrown you out of the court, according to him. Now you go back to yourself and ask yourself, you want to teach, however. So how to teach? you have to be sure on your own that truly what you are saying is not hallucination. We have dismissed you as somebody subject to hallucination. But you want to be sure on your own, true, it is not hallucination. On what grounds do you believe that it is not hallucination? There are three grounds on your side on which you can still show that it is not a hallucination. Even in your subjective experience, you have hallucinations. And you can detect whether it is hallucination or not. Even in your subjective experience, it is not that only in objective experience there are hallucinations and you can detect whether it's hallucination or not. Even in your subjective experience, you have hallucinations. And you can distinguish very well that this is hallucination and this is a real experience. You know fire light being seen by you in a drunken condition. And fire light being seen by you, not in that condition, but which are not seen by others. They are invisible to you, invisible to the others, and yet you can make a distinction between the two. In other words, you might say that there is in the subjective experience a capacity to distinguish between hallucination and the real experience. Now, how do we make a distinction? We can make a distinction when you can repeatedly perceive identity. It's a new concept I'm introducing now. When you can perceive identity subjectively, then you can say that when same thing is identically seen again and again, then you can say it is true as distinguished from a hallucination, which can be seen sometimes, but they are not repeatedly identical in the case of hallucination. This experience of identity is one of the most fundamental things in the field of knowledge. In fact, some of the materialists have been able to perceive this point. This is another group, you might say, of materialists. Bertrand Russell, for example, belongs to this group. The best type of materialist, you might say, who says that there is one experience which you cannot objectively verify, but which nonetheless is true. Or even it is objectively verified, even in physical terms later on. But the real proof is in pure subjectivity. What is that experience? It is the experience of recognition. How do I recognize that this is Sarita whom I have seen yesterday? What is the proof that this is the same Sarita which I had seen yesterday? I recognize her very well. Now remember that this is a very deep question, because basically I recognize you in my subjectivity. That whom I had seen yesterday was not before me, therefore not physically seen by me now. So that whom I had seen, which I now only subjectively know, is not objectively known now, is the same as the impression that I have received now from outside, which is also my subjective perception, and I am tying up these two perceptions subjectively. And subjectively I know that this is the same as that one, identity. Bertrand Russell accepts that there is one experience, he says, materialism cannot explain. He admits very clearly. He wrote a book called Analysis of Mind. It's a very big book, Analysis of Mind, in which he tried to show that all that you see, all that you experience can be physically verified, purely on materialistic terms. But having done all kind of analysis, he comes to this experience of recognition. And he says, I have not yet found a materialistic answer to this experience of recognition. Of course, he says, one day I'll find out. That is another matter. But so far, at least, he says, I am not able to find a physical answer to this question.
It does not respond to remembrance.
Pardon?
It does not respond to remembrance.
True, but what is remembrance? Precisely. It's purely subjective. Your verification is subjective. And yet I believe it is true. It's not hallucination. A subjective verification which gives you a standard of truth. So merely saying it is subjective is no argument. Actually speaking, it may be argued that all knowledge is basically subjective. Fundamentally, all that you are perceiving, even from outside, even if five people see the same thing, each one perceives subjectively. It is my subjective consciousness which understands what is objective, which gives currency to objectivity, but that is all based upon subjectivity. Agreement of my subjectivity with your subjectivity is understood by whom? By your subjectivity and my subjectivity. Therefore, subjectivity has a capacity of understanding what is objective and therefore what is true and what is not true. You don't need to have physical proof for saying whether it is true or not. A subjective capacity exists. Now, this is a proposition which opens up a field for a new inquiry. Once you grant this, some materialists can see this point, as Bertrand Russell has said. But although he still says, I will find out a materialistic answer in future, which during his whole lifetime he couldn't. There are two or three questions which he had said, I will find out materialistic answers to those three questions. But until the end of his life, he could never. In any case, this is the one door on which now you have a better field and you can say, now you institute an inquiry. Now, when you institute an inquiry, you find something very interesting. But to start with, let us take one simple example. We all have the experiences of chauffeurs who drive our cars. On what grounds do you allow your driver to drive your car in which you are seated? On what ground do you allow a chauffeur to drive your car in which you are seated? The only ground is that he has a judgment which is subjective, which he knows is true, subjectively. And you know that it is true. If you did not believe that his judgment is true, you would not allow a driver to drive your car at all. Now, on what ground do you believe that his judgment is true? There's a further ground, that he has got to be sincere in his perception. He has got to be sincere in his perception. That means you know that if somebody is insincere, he can perceive wrongly. But if he sees sincerely, he will perceive rightly. You know that if he sees insincerely, he will himself get killed. If he sees insincerely, he himself will get killed. But you know that if he sees sincerely, his judgment, his perception will be really right perception. Therefore, what is your criterion of believing that your driver will drive rightly? But he cannot but be sincere. Preservation of life being such a tremendous feeling in us that he cannot even play with insincerity. He cannot say, let me drive just like that for the sake of play. Even that is dangerous. He will die. He will crash. Therefore, the one criterion in subjective matters, whether something is true or not, is sincerity. A sincere perception. Sincerity itself is a fifth argument, basically.
Is it the unification?
The basic point, according to Vedanta, is that there is only one reality.
That is
the reason why we can see all this, we can share everything, because there is only one reality. And the important point is that even materialists, when they come to the experience of recognition, they see this proposition of identity. The experience of identity is so fundamental.
I wondered about this question.
But this is the real Vedantic answer actually. Because reality is one, the knowledge of the one is inherent in the one. Because there is nothing else. Because the one is conscious, if it was not conscious, then again this would not happen. The very nature of the one is conscious. The one being one and one being conscious, the one recognizing one is identical and therefore inevitable and indubitable. It can't be doubted. In fact, that is the only standard of truth, indubitability. If there is anything which is indubitable, it is the knowledge of the one that exists alone, which knows, which is conscious and therefore can know itself, is the only proposition which is really, you might say subjectively or objectively, that is the only reality, only truth. Now, this is the domain in which materialist has still not entered. We are now obliging him to enter into it. So, our argument is that all his arguments are based upon ignoring a large field of inquiry into which many people have made a great entry and also journey. And this is only the preliminary statement. You go further and you find that as you enter into that domain, you find so many experiences which have a system. A mere hallucination has no system. You can't have a system of hallucinatory experiences. A systematic. You enter into this and you find a system of experiences. When I see the blue color and I examine my consciousness, I find illumination. When I see green color, I find that I had in my consciousness a vital consciousness. It's a system. And whenever this happens, this happens. So you have in this field a system of experiences. And such a system that you can also develop criteria by which you can say, this can't be, this can be. If somebody says that, I was extremely happy, I got heavenly delight. And then he says, I saw everywhere green, green, green. If he says so, you can be sure that he had no heavenly delights. He says two statements. I was in heavenly delight and I saw everything green, green, green. You can be sure he had no heavenly delight because green is a symbol of the vital experience. See, it is true that he had a great vital experience, but not the heavenly experience.
So there can be criteria by which you can judge. All these are subjective fields, but you can judge. So first judgment is sincerity, which you can judge also. Whether somebody is sincere or not can also be judged. At least your own sincerity you can judge, if not from somebody else's. Whether you are truly sincere yourself or not can be judged by you, by your inner sincerity. You do know when you are not sincere, you do know when you are sincere. At least we all have experiences when we are sincere and when you are not sincere. This is subjective, but which is a criterion which can be proved to be true. Secondly, you have system of experiences which can give you further criteria of what is right, what is wrong. Thirdly, you have further experiences. You can go out of your body. You can jump into what was subjective, into a world which is now objective, as much objective as you are here, walking into this physical world. There are extraordinary experiences of going out of the body. And you go on perceiving things, not with your physical eyes, not with your brain. Brain cells are no more used there at all. You perceive things, and it's not brain cell at all working. When you come back again, you remember that you had gone out, you had seen certain things. Then, of course, brain may be at work. But that knowledge which you possessed at that time, it was not a result of brain cells.
Can some beings be put into this kind of...
Some dreams, yes, certain.
Out of body?
Surely, of course, certainly. Certainly. So there are experiences in which brain cells are not involved and therefore no physical organs are allowed. Therefore, to say that consciousness is connected with physical organs, that fundamental proposition of the materialist is now negated. That physical organs are not the only instruments of knowledge. And then you find that there are not one supraphysical world, but there are several supraphysical worlds. There are interconnections of them. We can send message from one supraphysical world to another supraphysical world. And all that we speak of the soul, spirit, is connected with this large field. When we say spirit, spirit is what? Spirit is a large field. Word is very simple, therefore we may think that it is simply a little thin chain. But that is not so. Spirit is more than universal. This whole universe is lesser than the spirit. It is more than universal. So that tremendously vast, in which so many communications are possible, and communications from there upon the physical. This is another point. That if you enter into this domain, you find experiences of such a nature that it has even physical effects. If the materialist is prepared, if he is a real inquirer, then he will enter into this field. Now, Sri Aurobindo says that fortunately, materialist of the highest kind is an inquirer. If he was not an inquirer, it would be a hopeless case. Although he resists, and resists quite a lot, therefore we had several degrees of materialism presented. But there are who are prepared and who can enter into it. In fact, many of us ourselves are materialists, and we are prepared to enter into it if there are real facts. I think most of the spiritual seekers are as materialistic as anybody else. It is not that they want to believe somehow. They don't believe in dogma. They do not believe in aptavakya. They would not even say, because of faith I enter. No. They have entered into a field where experiences of in a state of sincerity have brought them certain kind of knowledge which they can't reject. It's impossible to refuse. This is the ground on which you can say that we have arrived at the fundamental basis of a hypothesis that not matter but consciousness may be the real reality. The steam may be the reality, not the piston. This is the ground. That consciousness may be anterior to this physical world. The physical world is the world which is itself a resultant of consciousness and not the other way around. I think I'll stop here today, but some of the last portions of this dialogue we shall continue next time.
Consciousness is only the nature of the reality, so we have brought him only up to consciousness.
At least that much. We shall still go further into the nature of consciousness and see how it is real. Identity of consciousness and reality. Alright. But even with regard to materialism, we still have a little bit of dialogue further. So that we shall come to next time. Alright.